Our topic today is scientific pluralism, and we'll be looking at it from three different perspectives. And it's a pleasure to welcome our first speaker, Anya Kuczynski, who is a professor in the philosophy department at Washington University in St. Louis. She has a forthcoming book called Explaining Cancer, and I think we'll be hearing from some material that will find its way into that book. It'll be coming out with Oxford University Press soon. She's also co-edited a book on the philosophy of biology, and her title today is Cancer, Disunified Kind, Unified Explanation. Please join me in welcoming Professor Kuczynski.
First of all, thank you so much for having me here. I'm really thrilled and honored to be presenting at this colloquium. I've always looked at the list of talks to be given here and with great jealousy, wishing I could have gotten to see so many of them. So the topic of my talk today is cancer, and I wanted to use cancer as a lens through which to look at some of the recent literature on pluralism in science. Pluralism about taxonomy, pluralism about methodology, and pluralism about explanation. So I wanted to start with this image. Does anyone know what the image is? Anyone? This is a Serco plot. It's a representation of the cancer genome, which is a fictional object, of course, because there are thousands and thousands of cancers. And this particular image is based on a sample of many, many tumor biopsies that are then used to be sequenced. And then they use the sequences to derive information about which mutations occur most frequently across a wide variety of cancers. And then what this image represents is those particular mutations and how frequently they co-occur. So I thought this would be a nice image or representation of both diversity and an attempt at systematicity, which is really what science is about, right? We start with this blooming, buzzing confusion of the natural world, and we try to arrive at some sort of general characterization, general laws, general principles. So my goal today is to use cancer to challenge what I think is a very intuitive picture of science, one that I think many scientists accept, and I think that until relatively recently, many philosophers of science accept. What makes science successful? I think that we can more or less accept, or many of us will say, well, successful science aims at classification of natural kinds, right? And these natural kinds are supposed to underwrite the reliability of scientific prediction and explanation because natural kinds figure essentially in our scientific theories. Whether we think theories are families of models or sets of laws, natural kinds are supposed to figure centrally in those. And they enable prediction and explanation because they have stable co-occurring properties, and these stable co-occurring properties are supposed to be based on some causal structure or maybe some homeostatic mechanisms that cause them to cluster in the way that they do, or perhaps an essence. And kinds are supposed to be ordered hierarchically. So higher level kinds, the kinds of sociology, are supposed to subsume biological kinds, which are in turn supposed to subsume chemical kinds. And the idea, at least until relatively recently, that many philosophers of science accept, and I think many scientists still accept, is that likewise also explanations in the sciences are supposed to stand to one another in some kind of hierarchical relationship, whether that's a relationship of reductive relations or in terms of iterative decomposition of the object, identification of some sort of entities and processes and mechanisms, and then interlevel integration somehow. So the aim of my talk today is to push at these two particular claims, both that kinds are in fact ordered hierarchically, that there are no cross-cutting kinds, as Kalidi calls them, and also that explanations in science stand in this kind of relation. So this particular vision of science, I think evidence for my claim that many scientists accept it can be amply found in cancer genomics. So one of the central aims of the Cancer Genomes Project is to identify the essential features of cancers. The idea is once we identify what those central causal bases of distinct cancer kinds are, we'll better be able to predict and explain how different types of cancers will behave on the basis of these distinct genetic differences. So the Cancer Genome Project has been ongoing for the last 10 or 15 years. Millions of federal dollars have gone into it. The idea is that we're going to personalize cancer treatment and intervention by identifying the genes for specific cancer types and subtypes. But I want to push at some of the assumptions of this research program. When the advocates of the Cancer Genomes Program speak of each cancer's genome, what do they assume both about cancer and about success in science? And should we necessarily accept those assumptions? So one way to start investigating this problem is to look at scientific practice. And when you look at how cancer is classified both in the clinic and among different scientists, you find that classification of cancers is multimodal. There are distinctive ways to classify cancers for different purposes. So you might start with something like a hierarchical picture, right? So in general, you can say there are head and neck cancers, and then maybe jaw cancers, and then certain kinds of cells and tissues in the jaw, right? But there are also other ways to classify cancers based on histopathology, for instance. So grades have to do with the degree of differentiation of cells in a tumor. So a highly differentiated tumor is the kind you want to have because that means it looks more closely like the tissue of origin. Less differentiated tumors are bad, right? Because that means they're likely to be more advanced. That's a distinctive feature from stages. Stages have to do with the size of a tumor, the number of metastases, how much it's invaded. Those are distinctive features from the genetic alterations. So the same grade, the same stage might have different genetic alterations. And biomarkers have to do with expression of, say, a protein or the ability to respond to certain kinds of, say, estrogen, for instance. Those can be used for treatment decisions. It's also the case that cancer scientists classify cancers by remote etiology. So they speak of smoking-induced lung cancer and non-smoking-induced lung cancer. And it turns out that those are very different kinds of cancers with different genetic profiles and different prognoses. So you can imagine a conversation between a clinician and a patient, and I imagine this happens all too often, asking, what kind of cancer did you have? And all of the answers this particular patient gives are true, good answers to that question, because the question is vague. You could be asking lots of different things. What kind of cancer did you have? Lung. What kind of cancer did you have? Small lung cancer. Small cell carcinoma. What kind? Mildly differentiated, grade 2. Stage 2, right? All of these ways of classifying are legitimate, good ways of classifying cancer, and they serve different functions. So cancer researchers roughly classify these classifications in two general categories. Sorry. So there's the clinical pathological classifications, things that might help you make diagnoses and prognoses that are treatment relevant. And then there are the so-called molecular classifications. And like I mentioned at the beginning, the ideal behind the cancer and genome projects is that by identifying the essential genes, the molecular markers for distinct cancers, we'll get a much more scientific, precise, predictive science of cancer, and maybe we can sort of do away with these modes of classification. But it turns out that after 15, 20 years of research, perhaps not a surprise to many of you, we still use these modes of classification, and these are as, if not more, predictive of the behavior of any particular cancer in any particular patient. Knowing the stage and grade of your cancer is really, really important to knowing the likelihood of recurrence of the disease. And in fact, it turns out that even sex and age and history of infection and inflammation, all these other things are really important in predicting how a cancer will behave or how a particular patient will respond to treatment. So I want to contest here that what's going on is that there are multimodal classifications, and these are cross-cutting classifications of the sort that Khalidi discusses in that 1998 paper. Khalidi argues that the assumption that all of the classifications of natural kinds will stand in this hierarchical relationship, it just doesn't hold of actual scientific practice, that if you look at scientific practice, ecological kinds and biological kinds may not seamlessly align in this fashion, and I think cancer is an excellent example of this. Why? Why is cancer classification so complicated? Well, the same type of cancer in the sense of tissue of origin, like I mentioned earlier, in different patients can have different prognoses for lots of different reasons. Sorry to tell you all, gentlemen, here, but men are more vulnerable to cancer, and they're more vulnerable of recurrence of cancer by and large, with the exception of some few cancers, breast cancer being the obvious one, ovarian cancer or the others, right? Okay, so that's just a fact about our biology. How any particular cancer behaves, in other words, does it have to do only with cell intrinsic features, but cell extrinsic features? That is, the same mutations have different effects depending when and where they arise. Indeed, they have different effects depending on the order in which they arise. So if you have a certain kind of mutation earlier rather than later, that affects the progression of the disease in really interesting, complicated ways. And it turns out that cancer scientists relatively recently have been catching on to this. And what used to be called the six hallmarks of cancer, according to Hanahan and Weinberg, two major molecular biology researchers. Weinberg is actually here in Boston. Have broadened the way of characterizing cancer to include features of the tissue microenvironment, that is, features outside of the population of cells in a tumor that are called cancer cells, play a really important role in how and when and why a cancer is likely to progress. So you'd think that me and Khalidi are totally on board with one another, and I love Khalidi, and he's helped, and I'm supporting his view, but uh-oh. One more speaker. So not only is it the case that all these other features of the tumor microenvironment and the sex of the patient and so on and so forth affect cancer progression, each cancer is genetically unique, like species. So recently in JAMA, Gerlinger et al. Did a very generous patient donated their body to science, and they sequenced his entire, the evolutionary history of his tumor. So where it initiated, how it differed from the cells of origin, and then also the tumor metastases. So they were able to generate a phylogenetic tree of the different subpopulations of tumor cells and how they evolved over time. So that makes cancer classification really hard. Okay, the upshot. There are diverse cross-cutting ways of classifying cancers, which serve different purposes, and the hope for a definitive nosology of cancer, I think, founded on genomics alone, assumes that mutations are the distinctive causal factors in cancer, an assumption proving difficult to sustain in the face of empirical evidence. No single mechanism underlies cancer progression, and I want to suggest that complex phenomena, like cancer, may require a different picture both of kinds and their classification and of how we make progress in science. So here's Khalidi on cancer as a kind. I just wanted to shove in the knife here. I really like Khalidi, but then I read his book and I thought, oh yay, Khalidi's gonna provide great ever more reason for me to for my view. And sadly, he's defending the view that cancer in general is a homeostatic property cluster kind. And the reason why is as follows. The kind of entity that is most closely implicated with the process of cancer is the cancer cell. I will argue that once the cancer cell is understood as a natural kind of entity, then cancer can be seen as a natural kind of process. Of all the natural kinds we've looked at, this is the one most aligned with Boyd's homeostatic property cluster account. The mutated caretaker genes can be thought of as the causal mechanism, and I read that and I oh, Khalidi, you so disappointed me. Because, right, one of the whole thrusts of my argument here is that I just don't think that the particular mutations are the essential or the core causal mechanisms that distinguish cancer and its distinctive behaviors. And here's a beautiful paper by Egelblad and Nakasone and Verb that came out in 2010. So despite the fact that Khalidi is quite openly and clearly not an essentialist, I think he's being an essentialist about cancer when he says what makes cancer distinctive as a kind is these particular types of mutations. Cancer cells' properties are only one of the necessary conditions on cancer progression. And what's great about this paper is, and besides the beautiful images, is the fact that they show how the tumor microenvironment actually cooperates in the progression of metastasis. So all these cells, so cancer is often described as like a wound that never heals, right? So the immune system comes, the cancer sends out signals that say, send me blood supply, send me macrophages, right? Because I'm a disease, right? That they think, I'm a wound, I'm supposed to be a wound, right? And then they come along and they're like, we'll help you, and they break down the tissue, and they enable the cancer to metastasize by breaking into the blood supply, and moreover, platelets accrue around the tumor cell, the metastasis cell, and act as a disguise so that the immune system doesn't actually attack the tumor cells when it goes out to metastasize the body. So the progression of cancer, what's essential, if you like, the mechanisms for cancer, I don't know where they are, but they're definitely not all and only inside the cancer cell. Okay, so I want to draw an analogy here between cancer and aging. I think that there's a fellow named Williams. He's done a nice job. He wrote a paper called Arthritis in Nature's Joints. And he suggests something like this analogy. I think it's a really nice one. So when you think about what's essential to aging, right, you might think, well, telomeres have a heck of a lot to do with aging. It looks like they do because, well, men have shortened telomeres, or they shorten more quickly, and so men age more quickly. And so that must be why, right? It's essentially a genetic disease. But I think that cancer, like aging, and like perhaps depression and arthritis, is along this far end of a spectrum of dimensions of complexity of disease causation. I think that for infectious diseases, something like the old-fashioned essentialist view of kinds might work. There's a single initiator, a single pathogen, a single pathway, and the extent of interaction both within the pathway and with the genes and environment is relatively small. In the case of things like cancer, depression, and aging, it's not just a matter of genes breaking up. There are multiple initiators, multiple pathways, and the extent of interaction is quite strong across those pathways and genes and environment. Okay. So what do we do now, right? We've realized that cancer is a profoundly heterogeneous and complex disease, and we need to think about, well, what kind of picture of science then do we use that replaces the picture that I set out at the beginning? So when you look at cancer science, it is itself a massively disparate field. There's clinical medicine, which is distinct from epidemiology, which is distinct from evolutionary modeling of cancer, which is distinct still from looking at cancer genomics. And all these different enterprises often are ongoing independently. There is some interaction between them, but they're not clearly engaged in a unified enterprise. In fact, I realized how much like cancer was like the study of human behavior when I read Helen Longino's recent book, where she argues but what she does in this book is she looks at a variety of different disciplines that study human behavior, in particular aggression and sexuality, and she points out that this target of explanation, aggression, whatever it is, and is a very diffuse target that can be operationalized in lots of different ways. There are different disciplinary approaches with different methods and different questions. And she argues that they parse the causal space differently and arrives at the conclusion that we should be pluralists. Well, what does she mean by that? She writes, from an empirical point of view, what we know is piecemeal and plural. Each approach offers partial knowledge of behavioral processes gleaned by application of its investigative tools. In applying these tools, the overall domain is parsed so that effects and their potential causes are represented in incommensurable ways. We can and do know a great deal, but what we know is not expressible in one single theoretical framework. We may remain metaphysically committed to the view that multiple factors or processes are interacting in one world. So I've been trying to unpack exactly what her pluralism is, what she's committed to, and where I'm on board and where I depart from her, and how cancer is like and unlike the case of explaining aspects of human behavior like aggression and sexuality. So I'm going to share my conclusions with you now. First of all, I think that Angela Potocnik makes a very insightful point in her review of Longino's book when she points out that there's an uncomfortable tension in the book. On the one hand, Longinus argued for the continuing importance of multiple incommensurable approaches. Actually, incommensurable ways of parsing the causal space, but let's leave that aside, and yet urges greater interaction among the approaches. Incommensurability suggests an inability for one approach to speak to another, and on the other hand, interaction among approaches suggests integration that Longinus resists. So Longinus is clearly resisting reduction, and at various places she does say she resists integration. But I don't think that she should resist the latter. So I want to talk about what it really means to be a pluralist then, when we've got these complex phenomena, and why we ought to embrace pluralism about either taxonomy, methods, or theories. Can we consistently embrace a pluralist view and see at least part of the process of science as involving something like offering unified theories or more or less integrative theories? And when do we have productive interaction, when are integration successful? Here's how she defines pluralism, Longinus, on page 2 of the book. She says, inquiry may sustain a multiplicity of viable approaches, each generating some knowledge. The question becomes not which one is best, but why each contributes, both in terms of our positive results and in terms of critical perspectives on the others to our overall understanding. So this comes at the end of a long-standing defense of pluralism and diversity in science for Longinus. She has argued in other books that objectivity is improved upon by science by inviting a diversity of perspectives. But this pluralism is a little bit different, and I wanted to break it down because I think she's endorsing actually different kinds of pluralism here, and I want to talk about which ones I'm on board with and which ones I'm not sure about. So on the one hand, you could be a methodological pluralist, which is just to say that a variety of methods or disciplinary approaches, at least initially, might be heuristically useful and worth pursuing independently. That's different from what I'm going to call an epistemic pluralism, and this comes from a volume in the Minnesota Studies co-edited by Keller, Longinus, and Waters. They say natural phenomena cannot be fully explained by a single theory or fully investigated using a single approach. That's actually conflating two different. I think the second is more of a methodological. The first is an epistemic, right? But multiple approaches are required for investigation and explanation. That's different, however, from metaphysical pluralism, which is a somewhat stronger view. So Cartwright, in her 99 book, argues that laws of limited scope form a loose patchwork because the world itself, right, is disunified, right? And alternatively, a different kind of metaphysical pluralism is just promiscuous realism about kinds. In other words, that's more or less kind of what I'm saying about cancer classification, that we can be realist in different ways about a variety of different cross-classifications of kinds. That's not the same as saying the world itself is disunified in terms of laws of nature. Okay, here's where I stand. I think methodological pluralism is totally unproblematic. Of course, pursuing a variety of different approaches makes sense and is quite effective. Epistemic, I'm starting to get a little bit worried. So I think different aspects of the same phenomenon may require different explanations, and so success in science is going to then be piecemeal and multifaceted because we have diverse explanatory and predictive goals. Nonetheless, I do think there are general theories that can explain large classes of phenomena, but often, as Nancy Cartwright has argued, we trade explanatory scope for loss of precision and predictive power. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think about integration and how I think there are a variety of different kinds of integration in science. I'm going to talk about of greater depth and breadth than others. And lastly, I think that there is one world, but that doesn't mean we can't have legitimate cross-cutting classifications. Okay. So this comes from a paper by Maureen O'Malley and Sawyer, where they offer three different modes of integration in science. And I think it's very useful. And what I tried to do here is map on different enterprises in cancer research that approximate or try to follow these modes of integration in greater or lesser extent. So there are lots of mathematical models of cancer progression, and these are these look like sort of traditional theoretical mathematical models. Let's assume things that are completely false and predict how cancer would progress under these assumptions, right? And so these are often sort of theoretical mathematical integrative pictures of cancer, and they can be quite useful. They can test our assumptions. They can help us follow through with certain expectations under those assumptions. That's different from mechanistic integration, where what we do is we identify, say, a particular feature of cancer or capacity of cancer, and identify a particular entity or process or collection of entities and processes, and thereby a mechanism that subsumes that capacity. And I'll give some examples. That's different still from what people building those circle plots are doing. There, they're involved in data integration, which is actually much harder than you might think, because you have to make the data commensurable, which is really, really hard. There's all sorts of problems with like batch effects. It's really hard. And that's a real enterprise in science, and you can be more or less successful at it, but that's a different kind of integration than these. Methodological integration, I'm putting systems approaches in molecular biology in that direction, but I think that actually we could, I'm not sure where exactly to put it, and maybe you guys can help me. But I'm still not sure I understand what systems biology is or what it does, but I'll give you some examples. Okay, here's a really boring unifying theory, but it got tons of press. New York Times reported on it because they used the words luck in the abstract. So they said something like, I can tell you exactly what they said. They said, only a third of the variation in cancer risk among tissues is attributed to environmental factors or inherited predispositions. The majority is due to bad luck. New York Times, front page, right? So it's really boring, and when you talk to cancer scientists about this, they're like, duh. Right? Okay, so here's what they show. Okay, it's just a regression. So variation in cancer risk is explained by the number of stem cell divisions in a particular tissue. So they don't include all the cancers, which is a little bit of a problem, and we can talk about that later. But they map a regression of the number of stem cell divisions in the tissue with the incidence of cancer in that tissue, and they show, surprise, cells divide, mutations happen, some tissues have more stem cell divisions than others, cells that divide more often have more mutations, tissues with more stem cell divisions are more frequently subject to cancers, caveat, caveat, caveat. Right, so there's a very general, broad, unifying theory of cancer, but it's very bad at prediction, it's not precise, but it's true, right? So it's a true general unified theory, if you like, unified theories. 8%, I would say, of publications in cancer research look like this. This is what I'm calling mechanistic integration. You find a gene that's commonly mutated in cancer, the gene's associated with some function, the function is associated with a pathway, you find the pathway and how it affects downstream expressions of other genes, right? And then you show that the expression of those other genes is associated with various typical hallmarks of cancer cells, and then, surprise, you found that it's differentially expressed in mice, yielding pathology, and therefore you have identified the tumor-forming mechanism for this capacity. Assuming, of course, that it operates in the same way, in the same time, always, everywhere, right? Which is, like I said, a problem. I think where integration has greater depth and interest, at least, okay, this is my aesthetic preference, is when you start putting these mechanistic explanations in broader context. And so what happens now in a lot of this research is what they do is they build these regulatory pathways, and a lot of them look like circuit diagrams. So I had to ask my dad, who taught like electrical engineering, what this thing was. But I was wondering if I can explain it. Okay, so nodes play functional roles akin to things in a circuit. So some nodes interrupt the flow of information. These are open, some block, right, some activate. And they talk about the behavior of different nodes in the network. In this way, right? Things resist, they do work, and so on and so forth. And you can even find the master guardian executioner P53 in one of this. This is actually the title of a chapter in a textbook by Weinberg. You can find one of the nodes associated with P53, this particular module, and P53 is mutated in 30 to 50% of all cancers, and you can show how the particular associations of that mutation in the activity and behavior of cells works, and thereby generate this circuit and describe and explain how you would expect a cell with various mutations in these various locations to behave. But of course, signaling pathways in cells aren't like circuits. So if you looked at that image before, you have these floating interveners, cellular stress, right? DNA damage, right? Circuits are closed, right? Cells aren't. Cells exist in bodies. So a lot of these pathways are activated. There are paraffin signaling systems between cells, and there's hormones. There are all sorts of crazy stuff going on between cells and other cells. So, and even the geometry, the space in which the cells reside, affects how they behave. So a lot of these things are activated by these floating interveners, what I'm calling them, and they aren't uniform in their causal specificity. And they play lots of different functional explanatory roles in the behavior of cells, in particular cancer cells. There are no closed circuits in the cell. There are multiple inputs and endpoints. And they play a variety of different functional roles. So I think that this shows there's a sort of limit to the value of mechanistic integrative decomposition in cancer explanation. I think these integrations are one kind of integration, but in my view, they're kind of boring and limited in their explanatory power. So cells divide or fail to divide in response to lots of different external signals, and mechanistic explanations of subcellular pathways thus have this core limitation. They're always characterizations of one bounded subset of a wider system of regulatory controls, not surprisingly, because evolution has designed many, many different ways to prevent this kind of breakdown. So this is where it starts to get a little bit more trippy in my integration story. It gets a little bit complicated. So I think understanding the way in which cancer occurs requires stepping back and developing a more integrative perspective, drawing upon evolutionary theory and developmental biology. And there's this wonderful book by Wagner where he talks about evolvability and robustness in living systems. And what he talks about there is this idea of robust structures. These are entrenched structures that play central important roles and have lots of downstream import. But there's also this other feature of evolvable systems, which is that they have a variety of different quasi-independent parts. So having modularity can be really advantageous because those parts can vary independently without affecting the whole. And Wimsatt and Shake in the lovely paper point out that this leads to a certain kind of paradox. There's a tension. There are fitness advantages due to entrenchment, and there are fitness advantages due to modularity. But the two can't be achieved simultaneously. They call this the GE paradox. So on the one hand, modularity, functional redundancy, should decrease entrenchment by reducing independence between or dependency upon specific subsystem components, right? But entrenchment can be awfully useful. So I think one way of thinking about cancer is as a byproduct of the GE paradox. It's a byproduct of both entrenched elements, or particular kind of networks, with the set functional centrality of P53 and our modularity, the capacity for parts to vary independently without affecting the whole. Modularity makes it possible for a tumor to develop gradually in a specific organ without necessarily affecting the organism as a whole, which is why many tumors aren't discovered until it's too late. But cancer also co-opts those very same features which make us highly evolvable. So it's sort of like, it's kind of amazing. Cancers themselves can be more or less robust, and they take advantage of the very same plasticity that is unique to us as metazoans. The transition that allows metastasis is called the epithelial mesenchymal transition, and that's only possible in organisms with a mesoderm. And arguably, what makes us so evolvable as a lineage is that we have this interesting modular feature of our organization. So what I want to suggest is that an even more integrative explanation is one that takes into account
our evolutionary history and our developmental unique features. What cancer illuminates is how systems subject to multiple sources of breakdown can find stable, robust solutions. And this is really cool stuff. So there's all these guys doing this computational systems biology where they're suggesting that cancers can be more or less robust. They evolve more or less robust networks, and the functional organization of those networks can predict how a cancer behaves. Not the cell intrinsic mechanisms, not sort of lining up one mechanism after another, but how they interact is important to predicting the behavior of the cancer. So these guys are supposed to be especially robust functional organizations. Mm-hmm. And I cannot reproduce the argument for that, so but read the book. Okay. So I think there's another kind of explanatory integration going on here. Meyer made that distinction between proximate and ultimate explanations. And what Callicott does in a really nice paper in a co-edited volume on cooperation and its evolution is he suggested that when we explain, we're not just interested in evolutionary stories, and we're not just interested in mechanistic stories. We're interested in this third category, which is how these things come about in a lineage. And I think that the kinds of explanations that systems biologists are giving are looking at that, looking for those kinds of explanations. How complex functional organization arises so that tumors can be more or less robust, more or less likely to metastasize and cause serious problems. The advantages of this approach is, in a way, it's ever more integrative. What it does is it integrates this idea of co-option from evolutionary thinking, and it takes advantage of the idea that cancer cell populations are effectively evolving populations of cells. So we can see them as exhibiting some of the same dynamics as populations of organisms. So this leads to my conclusion, which I think is 5 minutes early because I spoke too quickly. I've argued here today that genomic features alone are insufficient for cancer classification, that cancer classifications are cross-cutting, and that we should replace this picture of science as hierarchically organized with explanations sort of leading out from the lowest level as deeply problematic and think about success differently. We have different kinds of explanatory and predictive goals, and the massive heterogeneity and complexity of cancer, as well as its evolutionary dynamics, means that we shouldn't expect the kind of decomposition and mechanistic interlevel integration as telling the whole story about how to explain this disease. Nonetheless, there are general theories, but they're boring. They don't predict much, they're not very precise, and there are indeed local mechanistic explanations of cancer, but we shouldn't assume that any particular mechanistic explanation of how this mutation affects this pathway is going to necessarily predict how it's going to affect a pathway in any particular cancer. In complex systems, mechanistic decomposition can only explain subsets of properties that have to be put together and require contextualization, and I think that's what systems biologists are trying to do. Thank you very much.
Intriguing talk. I want to just try and get you to say a bit more about why integration is so good. So it seems like integration is good because it serves maybe a kind of instrumental role in getting us to come up with better explanations, how it pushes science forward. But in a way, integration is sort of more allied to that old school unified hierarchical approach that pluralists wanted to have in the first place. And we know that competition can facilitate that same instrumental goal. So I guess what I'd want to hear is, so why integration and why not?
So I think you're trading in your question on different senses of integration. So you said competition is good, right? And so, yeah, I'm on board with that, and that argues for methodological pluralism, right? That's different from saying, say, data integration might be a good thing to have, right? Which is a very narrow claim, right? Saying, okay, how do all these independent pieces of information fit together, and can we align them in an interesting way? So I think integration itself is not one thing, and so the virtues of it are not, if you like, unified, right? Data integration might be important in some contexts and some stages of science.
mathematical theoretical integration of the sort that I described, where you got those dynamic mathematical models that's like, let's assume everything we know is false and then predict certain expectations. Those can be useful, but that's a different kind of integration from the mechanistic decomposition integration that I talked about in interlevel stories. I do have particular fondness for the systems biology integration because I think it's discovering really interesting new important features of cancer, but maybe that's just because it's like new to me, and so I think it's really cool. But I think that actually what it does is it pulls upon lots of different independent theoretical frameworks, and so drawing upon, for instance, developmental biology and evolutionary biology to understand cancer, I think is way overdue, and it's really important to understanding and predicting behavior of the disease, because cancers are populations of cells. So does that help answer your question? I guess I don't want to say integration in general is a good thing. I want to say this kind of integration is good here, maybe sometime in that one.
Okay, so it sounds like as far as it goes, data integration, good. Thinking about how everything hangs together in broad sense of the term, good. But methodological integration, not so good.
Well, I think that I want to preserve the integrity of subdisciplines because I think having those subdisciplines continue on is really important. So here's an example. Classical epidemiology, old school, none of the molecular stuff. We just, like, count people. That's really important to do, right? Nowadays, molecular epidemiology is like getting really popular. People want to say they want to integrate, right, the molecular data with the counting stuff. But I think that we shouldn't eliminate these old disciplines that do really important work just because we have new data. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think they answer different questions.
Thanks.
Thank you. That was a really interesting talk, and I had a zillion questions.
Oh, yay. Yeah.
Thank you. I'll try to restrain myself. First is the question about the relationship between interaction and integration.
Mm.
You talked about them as though that aim of interaction is integration. And I think that's a problem. And I think that interaction has other uses, other functions that are important for maintaining the value of pluralism.
Yes.
Second point is about the reduction to the... you want to resist the formulation of cancer in terms of the properties of the individual cells. But the one problem with that description that you didn't talk about is that it's internally incoherent in so many ways.
How is that?
And it shows up on your slides. For example, so the aim is to identify what are the units, the causal units for cancer?
Mm-hmm.
They're genes. How do we identify genes? Well, we look for gene expression.
Hmm.
This is slippage between genes and gene expression.
Oh, nice point, yeah.
That's a massive jump.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
In fact, when they try to identify the genes for cancer or the complex disease, like in the HapMap,
mm-hmm.
What they do is look for at SNPs.
Mm-hmm.
And where are the SNPs? They're all over the chromosome.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but they use the SNPs to identify genes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on what basis do they? Well, they must be near genes.
Yeah, no, there are...
In fact, what they're doing is affecting the expression, the transcription,
mm-hmm.
and not the genes.
Exactly.
So there's that kind of incoherence.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of slippage here, and there's a lot of inconsistency, and GWAS has huge problems, right?
Huge,
yeah.
Huge problems.
Yeah.
I think it's important to include those in your...
Oh, thank you. Okay. That's helpful.
I actually forgot that there had a question I had, but the fourth is about systems.
Oh, okay.
I'm actually very, very familiar with the attempt to describe the dynamics of cancer and other systems in terms of network,
mm-hmm.
Network dynamics and the different schools of that interpretation. But although it's integrated in its own terms, on its own level, the mm-hmm. striking thing about all of those approaches is that they're unintegrable with molecular biology.
Huh.
That is to say, yeah, they talk completely different languages and if you ask John Doyle or Barabasi analyzing the structure of the network structure tells you about the molecular dynamics, or vice versa.
They have nothing to say to them. Yeah. That's interesting. Okay. So, I hadn't thought about that. That's very helpful. Thank you. Okay. Hi.
You did a great job of explaining the various theories of cancer. I'm familiar with the somatic mutation theory is the one where the mutation occurs in the cell, et cetera. And there's been so much written now about the fact that there's too many epicycles. They keep trying to patch it up.
Mm-hmm.
And even Weinberg has agreed that it's more than just the cell mutating. There are all these interactions. My colleague at Tufts wrote a book 15, 20 years ago, The Society of Cells.
Yeah.
Sun and Shine, I don't know if you know
that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So his theory is the tissue theory of cancer or something like that, Tuft. That's been going on for a while, but the somatic mutation theory is still the one that drives therapy. It's still the one, you know, I've often told them is that you can come up with a therapy that is consistent with your theory, that there's tissue communication through the cells. You're golden, you know. Your theory will all of a sudden be dominant. So some of these theories...
Not so.
You mean if you come up with a theory that supports his view, it still won't be?
That's right. If you come up with a therapy...
A therapy, I mean.
...that is based on an epigenetic view of cancer, you can't get anywhere with it.
You can't
sell it because it doesn't fit into the...
But wouldn't it help push into another theoretical framework?
It doesn't.
Well, maybe it will. I always thought that the therapy would kind of get the doctor to say, wait a minute, if we've been operating on the wrong framework, namely the mutation of individual cells.
Well, I can tell you a story of somebody who has an alternative view that leads to a very simple therapy.
Yeah.
You can test it, and you can't pace the trans cell for 20 years.
Nobody will buy it. Yeah. And the therapy works.
We don't know.
But I'm saying, you know, if it was found to work, maybe it would shift the...
But he can't find anybody to...
Well, I agree. The somatic theory is so entrenched.
I do part ways just a little bit with, I mean, I agree with them that the tissue microenvironment is absolutely essential, but I think that they essentialize the theories. So I think that they tend to think that these are competing paradigms, and I don't know if I buy the paradigm story. I think that this is a long, complicated story of iterated debate and discussion, and there is if there is anything going on, it's people like Weinberg now saying that the tissue microenvironment is important.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's a divide anymore in that sense. Mm-hmm. And there are people looking at epigenetic mechanisms of cancer. Like, I just went to a great lecture at the WashU Med School on the role of epigenetics in cancer. So there's, WashU is mainstream, if any place is mainstream as far as medicine. So I think, people are on board with that. Whether it's going to have the downstream import and how, that's a hard, you know, long, I mean, it takes millions of dollars and decades of research, but yeah.
Let me preface my comments by saying that my experience, the most important factor in aging is staying alive. But the main thing I wanted to say is, as we were talking, constantly paint my mind the general concept of open systems and tendential laws.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that this is very important for understanding every open system. And I always, the example I give is a balloon rising is just as much an example of the tendential law of gravity as a stone falling.
Mm-hmm.
So when we investigate a law, we try to minimize the influence of the countervailing tendencies. But when we deal with any real open system, we have to look at the countervailing tendencies. So the fact that there's some causal factor and a difference in the expression really shows that there are countervailing tendencies. Are these concepts used in discussion? It seems to me they would be very helpful. Just one final one.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, let's say water is going to fall down,
mm-hmm.
you still need the concept of canalization, which I got from Gardner Murphy, and mm-hmm. it goes back to Genet. He's got to find a channel, a path to go down. So even the fact that it's going to flow down doesn't answer the problem. It's got to matter what particular channel it's going to use. Absolutely. And this, again, I think is a very useful concept in the study of any open system, in particular for cancer.
That's very helpful. Well, I mean, I used to have an ecology professor who said ecology is harder than physics. But, you know, physics is hard, too.
Oh, we use all the physics all the time. That's where I came from.
I mean, but I think that thinking about cancer is from the ecological perspective, right? Recognizing that this is like, the tumor exists in an ecological system. And some of the papers that I'm citing here, like Eckelblad, it does a really nice job sort of trying to incorporate that perspective, but not as much as it probably should.
So I wanted to add, bring back to the subject of natural kinds, because I'm seeing the outlines of an explanatory model here, and I've been working on an explanatory model myself, and I want to see, not about cancer, but scientific explanation in general. And it seems to me that maybe the pluralism that you're looking for is a pluralism about description, a sort of an underdeterminist model where you think that there are real things in the world, but there are an infinite number of ways to describe them, some of which support good scientific explanations, and some of which do not. So that has the virtue of being anti-reductionist, also maybe the vice of being anti-realist, but it allows you the kind of pluralism of explanatory stances that it seems like you're looking for. Would you characterize your view that the pluralism that you're after as being a kind of a pluralism about descriptions?
Well, I think I would go a little bit short of infinite.
Okay.
I mean, I think there are lots of different ways to classify and cross-classify, but the good classifications, the classifications that are going to be useful in science, are going to capture in some sense, and I know this is very vague and we can argue for a long time, but some sense, some feature of the causal structure of the world. Okay? But, you know, specifying what that means and how we pin that down, that's another chapter of the book, which you're welcome to read. I would love your feedback.
So I was wondering if it's a little bit continuous, like if you could say a little bit more, because I'm still a little confused about your position on the pluralism. And so in the slide where you differentiated the different kinds of intervention, methodological, epistemological, metaphysical, you sort of quickly sort of threw away the metaphysical and like, oh, there's one word, right? And like I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more, because I in my mind, it's not so easy to differentiate these things, like with the epistemological and the methodological and the metaphysical, because how do we know the world? I mean, like, you know, this. So there is a part of that, that the fact that that went so fast, I felt, was like sort of in contradiction to your very sort of pursuit of a more contextual
it did go very fast. There's a lot more to say. So I agree. I mean, oftentimes these things are very difficult to pull apart. I think that absolutely sometimes.
For a reason, right?
Yeah.
That is your very point. No? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, that's, I guess, the tension that I'm trying to sort of.
No, thank you. I'll have to think about that. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're right. I do think that, I guess, where I wanted to part ways with Longinot is the idea that, I mean, I think that she's very resistant to the idea of integration, in part because of a long history of being resistant to reduction. So she's resistant to the kinds of mechanistic reductionistic explanations for good reason, right? For the reasons that I gave why those are limited and have only narrow scope, right? But I don't think that means we should toss out that as one legitimate goal. So I guess I'm a pluralist in the variety of different explanatory goals we could be seeking, parsing out different questions and different objects of explanation. So a mechanistic explanation can answer one question, right? How does this gene affect this particular pathway in this particular system at this particular time, right? But if we want to understand the behavior of a whole cancer, maybe that's not going to tell us the whole story. Stringing a few of those together is not going to tell us the whole story. So I'm a pluralist about the ways in which we explain. And that's chapter 5. Okay. You're welcome.
We have at least two more questions. I was interested in the circuit diagrams, just because, do you know how long have you seen those show, how far back you've seen those showing up in the cancer literature?
It's a pretty new technology. I'm not sure exactly.
The first time I had to wrestle through the circuit diagrams was because the first systems biologist I know of is using them was Howard Odum when he's writing ecology textbooks.
A circle plot.
Oh yeah, yeah. They're back to, it goes back to systems biology.
Oh,
and
cool.
Howard Odum and Eugene Odum are using them when they're writing the 1950s and 1960s being eco.
Wow, I had no idea. Okay.
And the interesting thing, maybe for your purposes, is that he's using them because he's an ecosystem stability advocate, and so he's using it to show the robustness of ecosystems and the stability of ecosystems through the interlocking circuits.
I thought you said circo.
The circo diagram is the one at the very beginning.
Yeah, that's like a, you know, some software engineering
problem. The circuit diagram.
Yeah, no, I had run across that in Odum, right.
Those have been back for a while. Yeah. So I was just curious how those were linked in this discussion and the ecology discussion, because that's clearly the kind of systems biology that this is drawn.
Well, I don't know if I would call this a system. Well, this is not the typical image that you find in Weinberg's textbook. It's actually kind of most of his images are much more like box diagrams with very simple interactions. So this one, he's obviously deliberately choosing that form of representation to make a certain case. Right, that all these things are interrelated in a really important way. I'm familiar with it from Davidson's textbook on genomic regulatory systems, but I know it must go back further than that.
Yeah.
Though Davidson doesn't talk about cancer.
And yeah, no, and I had no idea they were using it in cancer biology. Okay. So it's, I'm coming from the ecological side of it.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know they were.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
I'll have to go. I mean, that would be a fun history to write, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
So I get the joy of the last one, and it's going to be off in space a little bit.
Oh, okay, good. Space. I like space.
So you told Lee that you were someplace close to being on board about descriptive pluralism, but not quite. And then you came back and you said that you like explanatory pluralism.
Yep.
But you come back, keep saying that your goal is causal features of the world. Do you have some unified view of what it is that is a causal feature? Is, to your mind, a causal feature a natural kind? Or is there a pluralistic perspective on causes?
So when I say I'm a pluralist about explanation, I'm a pluralist about modes of explanation. So the philosophical literature on this has been sort of this back and forth between, Kitcher and Gleamore and all these guys will say unifying explanations identify either sort of some, you know, structure which subsumes things or some sort of reduce things to the thing that are essential and what have you. And then Salmon comes back and says, you know, you have to have the causal structure and, you know, back and forth. I think that all of these, so I want to endorse the view that different modes of explaining are all identifying causes. That ends up committing me to a certain view about causes. I do think that there are population level causes, for instance. So I think epidemiologists, for instance, explain the rise of lung cancer in the 20th century in light of the rise of smoking in the 20th century. They did that without appealing to any molecular mechanisms. So it ends up being the case then that I have to adopt sort of kludgy view about causation. I think that when we're talking about causation, we're talking about lots of different things, and we can't metaphysically reduce it to some sort of fundamental thing. I think that Woodward has pretty much got it right. That the best we can do is sort of offer a general operationalization of causal inference in terms of intervention. But what it means to intervene at the sort of fundamental physical level, and can it all and only be this kind of pushing and pulling, that kind, I have an